is the news.
Lebanon is reeling from deadly violence that broke out during Thursday protests against the probe into last year's Beirut port blast. Iran condemns the deadly attack on a peaceful protest in Beirut, saying Lebanon will successfully overcome Israeli-backed seditions. Also ahead, the UN says more than 20 million Yemenis are in need of humanitarian assistance, as the country's economy is collapsing. Welcome to the program. Lebanese army has deployed soldiers to the capital, Beirut. That comes a day after the city witnessed violence during a protest against the probe into last year's port blast. At least 9 people have been arrested in connection with the violence. It all began as gunfire broke out during the protest against a judge conducting the investigation. 6 people lost their lives, dozens more were injured as a result. The protest had been called by Hezbollah, with protesters accusing the judge of being swayed by the U.S. Reports earlier blamed the Christian far-right Lebanese Forces political party for starting the gunfire and said they had planned confrontation in advance. Now new reports say Interior Ministry officials have unanimously agreed on that narrative. Lebanese president also pledged to hold accountable the perpetrators.
What happened will be the subject of security and judicial follow-up, and I, for my part, will ensure that the investigation reaches the truth of what happened in order to hold those responsible and instigators to account.
Lebanese government has declared Friday a national day of mourning for the victims of the Thursday violence. The country's Supreme Islamic Shia Council decried the unrest as an unspeakable crime. There have been reactions from outside Lebanon as well. Iran has condemned the killing of the protesters. It said the Lebanese people, government, and army alongside the resistance will successfully leave behind Israeli-backed seditions. Russia called on all sides in Lebanon to show restraint. The UN urged Lebanese parties to refrain from provocative acts.
Beirut has once again been mired by violence. This time the violence was one-sided. At least 6 people were killed and 60 others wounded after gunmen shot at peaceful protesters in El Tayuni roundabout in Beirut. The Lebanese army deployed heavily to contain the area and clear it from any armed presence. The Lebanese Interior Minister stressed that the incident of sniper fire is unacceptable.
We didn't have any intelligence that such an issue will occur. The organizers of the protests had confirmed that the protest was peaceful. The problem began when the first sniper bullet was shot. It was clearly a sniper fire since the wounds were in the head and the martyrs were all from one side.
Hezbollah and the Amal movement in a joint statement accused the Lebanese Forces party of attempting to drag the country into civil unrest, calling on its supporters to show self-restraint. What started as a peaceful protest turned into a massacre against unarmed protesters, whose only crime was denouncing what they see is an unfair and politicized probe into the Beirut port explosion. The popular protest was in tandem with a sit-in by experts at law who demanded that current judge prosecutor in charge of the Beirut port explosion investigation be either removed or that he works by the standards of impartiality, as stipulated in legal standards.
We support accountability against anyone who is in authority and is accused of mismanagement, and they should bear all legal allegations. However, this should be done through the principle of a transparent investigation to uncover the truth and in respect of the Constitution and Lebanese laws and reputation. These victims of the port blast and their families are our families, and we want to uncover the truth more than they do.
Judge Tariq Vitar, the judicial investigator into the Beirut port blast, was accused by several members of the Lebanese parliament of being selective and political in his charges.
There's clear partiality in selecting the individuals he wants to take to court. There were 12 ministers who were in those portfolios. Then why did he only choose 4 from one political group? Why did he select one prime minister from 3 prime ministers? Why is the judicial system insulting the Legislation Council? There's a law that stipulates that members of parliament and ministers are tried in the parliament and not in the judicial council.
Bitar was notified on Monday of a lawsuit regarding his neutrality in the investigation, putting the probe on hold. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Well, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held a rally in solidarity with the Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails who have begun their hunger strike to protest Israeli authorities' inhumane treatment. Ruba Shabit is in Gaza.
In solidarity with the Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails, Palestinians held a demonstration in front of the Red Cross headquarters in the Gaza City, demanding an end to the recent Israeli strict treatment against the inmates. Following the recent jailbreak of 6 inmates from the high-security Jabal prison, Israeli regime keeps practicing inhumane policies and increasing abuse against Palestinian detainees.
We are here to send this message to our prisoners that we won't leave them alone in this battle against the Israeli regime. We won't remain silent over the violations of the rights of our inmates in Israeli jails. The international community should make an urgent action to provide protection for our prisoners.
According to the Palestinian Prisoners Club, thousands of Palestinian detainees from Islamic Jihad have begun their open-ended hunger strike on Wednesday, protesting the Israeli violations and torture inside jails.
Following the heroic escape operation by 6 inmates, the Israeli regime began to intensify its inhumane torturing policies against our brothers, especially the Islamic Jihad members. Our prisoners have started their hunger strike protesting the inhumane policies of the Israeli regime.
In his speech, the Secretary General of Islamic Jihad, Ziyad al-Nakhala, announced the movement's readiness to respond firmly against the Israeli violations of prisoners' rights, even if this leads to a new round of violence.
We are here today to support our prisoners who have begun their hunger strike. We call on the international community to stop these violations. We warn the Israeli regime that it will face a firm response if these punitive measures are not stopped. Israel is responsible for the lives of our detainees.
About 400 prisoners who belong to the Islamic Jihad movement have begun their hunger strike with the support of other factions. The strike is in protest of Tel Aviv's inhumane measures against Palestinian prisoners, intensified following the escape of 6 inmates from a high-security Israeli prison last month. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Iraqis protest against the results of the Sunday parliamentary elections amid reports of voting irregularities. Different factions have objected to the initial results that saw a bloc headed by influential cleric Muqtada Sadr coming first with 70 seats. The Fatah Alliance rejected the results as fabricated. After reports of fraud, Iraq's Electoral Commission started the manual counting of a portion of ballots, which has changed the results in some districts. Final results are yet to be announced. No single political bloc has won a majority in the 329-member parliament. Yemen's humanitarian crisis is worsening, its economy collapsing. That is what the UN Deputy Humanitarian Chief has said as he addressed the Security Council. Ramesh Rajasingam has also said the conflict in Yemen is growing more violent. He said more than 20 million Yemenis are in need of humanitarian assistance. That amounts to 2/3 of the population there. The UN official said 8 agencies are now helping more people than before, pushing back the immediate risk of large-scale famine. But he warned the agencies would face problems as they are once again starting to run out of money. As a result, he said up to 4 million Yemenis could see their food aid reduced in the coming weeks. Yemen's been ravaged by the Saudi-led war that began in March of 2015. Iran has warned the International Atomic Energy Agency over its silence toward Israel's nuclear program. Iran's ambassador to Vienna-based international organization said silence and negligence toward the issue send negative signals to members of the non-proliferation treaty. Qasem Gharibabadi regretted that being outside the treaty means having no commitments and not being subjected to criticism. This comes after the IAEA chief's response when asked about focusing on Iran's nuclear program while keeping silent about Israel's. Rafael Grossi argued that Iran is an NPT member while the Israeli regime has not even signed a treaty. Israel is believed to be the only possessor of nuclear arms in West Asia and is estimated to have hundreds of nuclear warheads in its arsenals. Moving on, Britain says the European Union needs to make a significant change in order for a solution to be agreed on Northern Ireland. Brexit Minister David Frost says Britain wants a major concession on the role of the European Court of Justice oversight in Northern Ireland. The UK has previously opposed any role by the court. That is while the EU proposed using the court as arbiters to resolve post-Brexit disputes. The British minister now says the governance issues must be addressed seriously. He also says the latest EU proposals, and as they stand, are ultimately unacceptable. The bloc offered those proposals Wednesday to ease the transit of goods to Northern Ireland. A protocol on trade in the British province was part of the Brexit deal London and Brussels reached last year.
Relations between the EU and Britain remain at an all-time low. The so-called Northern Ireland Protocol was agreed almost 2 years ago and is a key part of the Brexit deal. Despite having negotiated it, Boris Johnson now says the protocol is not working. The EU has just put forward proposals to alter it.
We have completely turned our rules upside down and inside out to find a solid solution to an outstanding challenge.
Under the changes, checks and controls on goods moving from Britain to Northern Ireland will be reduced by more than half. EU laws will be amended to allow medicines licensed in Britain move freely to Northern Ireland. The EU sees the protocol as essential because it prevents border controls between Ireland, which is a member of the bloc, and Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK.
The Good Friday Agreement has to be preserved and no return to a hard border. The British have to work that out with ourselves here in Europe and with Ireland, but that has to be a bottom line for us.
Since Brexit, anti-EU political parties have been established in almost every one of the bloc's 27 member states.
We're being dragged into an EU army. They're imposing laws and regulations upon us which hurt the Irish economy. And now the corporate tax regime, they're after us for that. So Ireland, as things move forward, the benefits are reducing.
Analysts say the fallout from Brexit could also spell big trouble for the United Kingdom. There's growing support in Northern Ireland for a referendum on a United Ireland. Meanwhile, the Scottish National Party is waiting in the wings to call a second independence referendum that could very well see the breakup of the United Kingdom. EU officials are currently in London to try and avert an all-out trade war between the bloc and Britain. EU Commissioner Šefčovič will travel there on Friday to meet his opposite number, British Brexit Minister David Frost. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Let's move on to another story now. As some may forget that the issue which initially, if you remember, compelled France's yellow vests to hit the streets was record high gasoline prices. Now, the price of diesel gas just hit a new record in France amid across-the-board inflation. Now, the question is, will popular discontent return less than 6 months ahead of the presidential election? Ramin Mazohiri is in Paris.
In October 2018, a liter of fuel in diesel-dominated France hit €1.53. And for the next 7 months, every Saturday in Paris was a war zone of state repression. The price of diesel gas has just surpassed that all-time record, and many wonder if a return of the yellow vests is now around the corner. After the unprecedented corona lockdowns, diesel, petrol, natural gas, electricity, and prices in general continue to soar worldwide. Inflation in France has just accelerated to the highest rate in 10 years. Western leaders continue to insist the inflation is temporary, but many in France say the economic tension is undeniable.
I would very much like Macron to recognize that the French cannot live with this type of inflation. I normally budget 60 euros to fill up my car, but today I paid 80 euros. All these price increases in so many areas are a real catastrophe for the French.
Gasoline taxes are regressive taxes because they place the same costs on rich and poor alike. 60% of France's gasoline costs are due to taxation. Many drivers wonder if the right-wing government of Emmanuel Macron is prepared to ease this winter's burden on the average household by making the wealthy and big business pay a fair share.
The government must stabilize the petrol prices at a normal level. That would permit the people to get some financial breathing space. But the main problem is that of the salaries. Both the legal minimum salary and the national average salary are not sufficient for the people to live upon anymore. And this has to be openly admitted and changed.
As cold weather nears, a 250% increase in natural gas is forcing European governments to take last-minute action, including caps to corporate profits in left-leaning Spain. France's government is set to announce a small one-time payment for only the poorest households to combat energy costs, which show no sign of easing. France uses the third most natural gas in Europe. The persistent price rises and entrenched unemployment may upend Western plans to finally end quantitative easing and zero interest rate policies, which have produced record economic inequality. Those policies and the disastrous corona recession may have already set the stage for the next economic era across the West, dreaded stagflation. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
And that's it with international news.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We continue from where we left you last week, and here is Ayah 16 of Surah Qaf.
وَلَقَدْ خَلَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ وَنَعْلَمُ مَا تُوَسْوِسُ بِهِ نَفْسُهُ وَنَحْنُ أَقْرَبُ إِلَيْهِ مِنْ حَبْلِ الْوَرِيدِ.
And certainly we have created man, and we know to what his soul tempts him, and we are nearer to him than his jugular vein.
Thank you.
If you might recall, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah last Friday, we had said that in debates with the deniers of truth, we should apply the rationality of the cross-questioning method in order to awaken their minds and guide them to the ultimate truth. In view of the fact that those who do not believe in the day of resurrection have no logic and only express their doubts, the ayah that we recited to you refers to Almighty God's omniscience in knowing every minute thing, including the future, and his majestic attributes of originating creation. Thus, the Creator is all aware of the outward and inward qualities and deeds of his creatures, and is fully aware that the disbeliever's denial of resurrection springs from deviation and temptations, despite the fact that their innate natural disposition is aware of their origin. It means to say that if only the deniers of resurrection made use of their God-given reason, they would have resisted satanic temptations and acknowledged the veracity of resurrection without entertaining any doubts as to the same. In other words, Allah created human beings, and thus, as the Almighty Creator, he is aware of mankind's inherent weaknesses. He gave mankind intellect, consciousness, and free will. As for the phrase, nearer than the jugular vein, it implies that Allah knows more truly the innermost state of every person's feelings and consciousness than does that person. The Arabic word warid means the vein is connected to the heart and liver through which blood flows, while waridan are applied to the twin blood vessels connecting the heart to the brain on which the body depends for survival. It is one of the closest things to a person's life, since if blood flow suffers from any defect, the person will die. Thus, since existence of every person depends upon God Almighty, he is closer to us than our jugular vein that keeps us alive. Such closeness reflects that God Almighty is closer to us than anything else, and consequently aware of anything, even thoughts and intentions that flash across our mind, as well as temptations occurring in our hearts. The All-Merciful, however, does not punish mankind for evil intentions and thoughts, unless these are turned into action. This ayah teaches us that, number one, the Almighty Creator's knowledge and power are infinite, and everything is in his control. Which means, if a person thinks that God is unaware of his thoughts, he is in grossly mistaken. Number two, like our bodily organs, we should take proper care of our soul in order to prevent it from falling prey to satanic temptations. Now let's listen to ayahs 17 and 18 of this surah.
إِذْ يَتَلَقَّى الْمُتَلَقِّيَانِ عَنِ الْيَمِينِ وَعَنِ الشِّمَالِ قَعِيدٌ مَا يَلْفِظُ مِنْ قَوْلٍ إِلَّا لَدَيْهِ رَقِيبٌ عَتِيدٌ.
When the twin recorders record a person's deeds, seated on the right hand and the left, he says no word, but that there is a ready observer beside him. These ayahs means that divine omniscience, in order to document every person's inward and outward deeds, has assigned two angels to keep records that can never be refuted on the resurrection day. The two angels do not actually sit on the right, but always accompany a person from both angels to keep detailed record of deeds, even noting down every single word uttered. God the All-Merciful, however, has instructed the angels that in case of a bad deed or bad words, to grant the said person some hours before noting them down in order to provide ample opportunity for repentance and seeking forgiveness. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, although God is all aware of our inward and outward deeds, words and thoughts, He has assigned angels for every person so that all actions and intentions are recorded as documented proof. Number two, it is obvious that our human eyes are not designed to perceive angels who are invisible, since their essence of creation is different from that of all earthly creatures. And number three, every person is responsible for not only his or her deeds, but for words uttered. So we ought to be careful and desist from evil actions or verbal expression that unjustly cause harm to others and to our own selves because of bad behavior. Now we recite to you ayahs 19, 20, 21, and 22 of Surah Qaf as the concluding ayahs of this week's episode.
وَجَاءَتْ سَكْرَةُ الْمَوْتِ بِالْحَقِّ ذَلِكَ مَا كُنْتَ مِنْهُ تَحِيدُ وَنُفِخَ فِي الصُّورِ ذَلِكَ يَوْمُ الْوَعِيدِ وجاءت كل نفس معها سائق وشهيد لقد كنت في غفلة من هذا فكشفنا عنك غطاءك فبصرك اليوم حديد.
When the agony of death brings the truth, this is what you used to shun. Then the trumpet will be blown. This is the promised day. Then every person will come forth on the scene of resurrection accompanied by two angels, that is, a driver pushing forward and a witness testifying all words and deeds. You were certainly oblivious of this. We have removed your veil from you, and so your sight is acute today. At the moment of death, every person loses his or her consciousness. It means the stupor of death, accompanied by agony and loss of consciousness, is the moment of truth which people had tried in vain to evade. The next stage will be the resurrection of every person, heralded with the blowing of the great trumpet for the final judgment on the day that had been promised and foretold by all prophets of God, but ignored
by the disbelievers. Blowing the trumpet here refers to its second blowing, since, according to the Noble Quran and Hadith, the first blowing of the trumpet will cause every person to perish and no creature shall remain alive. Thus, upon the second blowing of the trumpet, all creatures find a new life and all the dead human beings emerge from their graves, even those whose bodies had been mutilated, burnt, and the ashes scattered will be assembled in their original form. Ayah 21 means to tell the disbelievers that no one may escape or deny reckoning on Judgment Day, as the two angels assigned for every person drive that person to the divine tribunal and read out from the documented record of deeds. The next ayah refers to the words of the angels, who tell the disbelievers in their custody, "This is the day against which you were warned by the prophets, but you were heedless. Today, the veils are removed from your eyes and your sight is sharp. You see what you used to disbelieve and deny." In other words, all transgressors and disbelievers shall have a clear vision to see the consequences of their evil, which they could not perceive or deemed improbable during their life on earth. In contrast to the miserable fate of the disbelievers, hypocrites, and the sinners who face divine wrath, the souls of the believers at the time of their death willingly turn toward the other world, and the angel of death will bear to them the glad tidings of paradise on its bounties. Divine mercy will be bestowed upon believers and veils will be cast from their eyes and they will see the abodes prepared for them. From these ayahs we'll learn that, number one, there is no escape from death for any person or creature. Number two, the agony of death will occur to every human being, since the fear of death and anxiety of its aftermath make them, especially the disbelievers, lose their senses. Number three, it is the negligence of afterlife that causes people to indulge in worldly greed, pleasures, and oppression of the rights of others. And number four, the mortal world acts as a veil and prevents human from perceiving facts and realities, but on the day of resurrection these veils are removed and every person will realize the plain truth.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. The UN Human Rights Council has voted to shut down its war crimes investigations in Yemen How can this be the case when at least 100,000 civilians have been killed in the Saudi-led onslaught on the Yemeni people?
The United Nations Human Rights Council has voted against renewing the body's mandate for investigating possible war crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Members narrowly voted to reject a motion brought by countries including the Netherlands and Canada to give UN investigators another 2 years to monitor atrocities in Yemen. It marked the first time in the Council's 15-year history that a resolution was defeated. Ahead of the vote, UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet said there was no peace in sight in Yemen and that urgent funding was needed to avert large-scale famine there. Meanwhile, the Dutch ambassador called the vote a major setback, adding that the Council failed the Yemeni people and cut their lifeline to the international community. Rights activists had previously warned that Riyadh was heavily lobbying against the resolution in a blatant attempt to ensure blanket impunity for crimes and other violations of international law in Yemen. They also accused the UNHRC of bowing to Saudi pressure and putting politics before principle. Experts believe the Council has lost its credibility by shutting down the investigation.
UN Human Rights Council has lost any credibility it once had, and that was marginal anyway. But by shutting down an investigation into atrocities committed in Yemen, this is something that is clear to anybody that horrendous things are happening in Yemen. And the fact that some other countries have strong-armed those council members to vote against this is just politics, but it's corruption and it's tragic for the people of Yemen.
This is not the first time Saudi Arabia has used what many call arm twisting to stop the UN from scrutinizing the Yemen war. Back in 2016, Saudi Arabia was removed from the UN's list of children's rights violators after Riyadh threatened to cut off crucial funding to the world body. The Saudi-led war on Yemen has claimed tens of thousands of lives and displaced millions, resulting in what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The coalition, which is logistically and militarily supported by the West, especially the US and the UK, has repeatedly bombed schools, hospitals, and other civilian facilities during its 7-year onslaught. The United Nations has in the past been criticized for its inaction against Riyadh, but the latest move by the Human Rights Council seems like giving a green light to Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies to continue their atrocities against impoverished Yemen with impunity.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this program, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Mr. Zafar Bangash out of Toronto. And political commentator and peace activist, Brian Terrell out of Molloy, Iowa.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start this off with Zafar out of Toronto. Isn't even saying that investigations will be stopped into possible war crimes ironic to begin with? I mean, when there have been so many civilians killed, shouldn't it be obvious that war crimes have been committed?
Oh, absolutely. I think the manner in which they UN Human Rights Council has acted is absolutely scandalous when it is well known and well established that At least 100,000 people have been killed in Yemen since March of 2015, when the Saudis launched their murderous assault on that poorest of countries in the Middle East. And more than a million children are suffering from cholera. The UN agencies themselves have said that the vast majority of the Yemeni people are on the verge of starvation. And for the UN Human Rights Council now to vote to end the investigation into Saudi crimes is absolutely scandalous. I think we also need to keep in mind that the Saudi regime has an atrocious record even at home. There are tens of thousands of political prisoners in Saudi Arabia. Dissidents are murdered, they are shot to death, they are executed. All kinds of other oppressions are taking place inside Saudi Arabia. But in terms of its crimes in Yemen, I think it is well established. I mean, the UN itself has said that there have been hundreds of thousands of casualties over there. The UN itself has said that there is mass starvation, that children are suffering terribly. So to stop this investigation into Saudi war crimes makes a mockery of the UN Human Rights Council and the manner in which it conducts its business.
Well, Brian, Yemen has actually just commemorated an attack on a funeral procession 5 years ago where over 100 people were killed. How can the Saudis get away with that and such an act not be considered a war crime?
Well, it is certainly that was one crime of many, and I think what it comes down to is the U.S. and other Western countries, the arms manufacturers, are making a lot of money off of this, and a investigation into the war crimes is inconvenient, you know, to those. Back a year ago, earlier this year, when it appeared that the United States, President Biden, was talking about cutting off the weapons flow to the Saudis, and the head of CEO of Raytheon Corporation told his stockholders, you know, peace is not going to break out anytime soon in the Middle East, and we will continue to see this an area of continued growth. I think it's also you know, the politics involved is you know, it's a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, Saudi Arabia tried to get a seat on this very council, the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, and was defeated. But the bid to stop this investigation was led by the ambassador from Bahrain. And I've been to Bahrain, and to say that the Bahrain, the Hamad monarchy in Bahrain is a government for the people of Bahrain with their welfare and interests at heart is really absurd. It really is. It's a Saudi proxy, and this is how the Saudis have been able to do this. They really do have a seat on this council. Only it's named after the Kingdom of Bahrain.
Well, Zafar, why haven't we seen more intervention to stop the carnage by the Saudi regime in Yemen from the so-called international community again?
Well, basically, as Brian pointed out, it has a lot to do with the sale of weapons, and Saudi Arabia is the largest importer of weapons in the Middle East by far. And in fact, even in terms of weapons imports worldwide, Saudi Arabia is right there at the top. And we need to keep in mind that in weapons sales, the return on profits is enormous. And so the weapons manufacturers want to encourage more wars so that their weapons are sold, so that they can their weapons are used, so that they can sell more weapons. And so wars for them is a profitable business. And that's why we see that around the world, countries like the United States, Britain, France, other weapons manufacturers are very happy to see these wars continue, even when the Saudis are perpetrating horrific crimes. And we also need to keep in mind that these Western countries are also guilty of war crimes, just as the Zionist regime in occupied Palestine is. And, you know, let's remember back in earlier this year, the International Criminal Court actually said that they have the right to investigate Israeli crimes against the Palestinians. And when the ICC chief prosecutor was changed in June, because her term ended in June and a new chief prosecutor came on board, this matter against the Zionist regime has gone silent. So we see that not only the Saudi crimes in Yemen, but the Western regimes themselves are guilty of horrendous crimes against humanity, and therefore they're not going to push for any investigation of Saudi crimes. The only time they push for any investigations is if there is a government or a ruler that is that does not toe the American line, then they go after such a government or particular ruler, and they try to haul that particular ruler before the International Criminal Court. So in this case, we see that there are definitely double standards being applied. I don't think that there is any doubt in the minds of anybody that Saudi Arabia is a gross violator of human rights. It has committed war crimes in Yemen. But unfortunately, there are countries around the world, Western countries, that are quite happy supplying it weapons, and they want to shield the Saudi regime from any criticism or any investigation that will haul these criminals or they bring these criminals to justice.
Ryan, what do you make of what Zafar just said? So if the case is so that these many of these Western governments are also involved in war crimes, whether in Yemen or other places, and continue to basically shield Saudi Arabia. So, I mean, isn't the whole concept then of a United Nations Human Rights Council, and even perhaps the United Nations itself, when these countries have so much power on a committee like that, or in the United Nations itself, like the Security Council, I mean, at the end of the day, what does it really do if these countries are also complicit?
Yeah, well, this instance calls to mind just a couple of years ago, the International Criminal Court was investigating the United States for war crimes in Afghanistan, and the United States responded by putting sanctions against the investigators. So, yeah, the Dutch ambassador has said, rightly, that the council has failed the people of Yemen, and in the most immediate sense, that's true, where you have 18 million people facing starvation in the very near term. But in the broader sense, this has failed the people of the world, and it's as has been mentioned, this UN Human Rights Council has had very little credibility. But what credibility it has really it is lost, and it's tragic for people who are looking for the people of the world, who are looking for ways that to solve problems through diplomacy, but of course, diplomacy doesn't bring in a lot of cash for the arms manufacturers, who really are more than our governments, more than our kingdoms and legislators, and more than the United Nations setting policy and setting the course of the world.
Safar, do you think that if Washington ordered Riyadh to stop the war today, that it could end today?
Oh, absolutely. The United States exercises enormous influence for a number of reasons. As you know, you mentioned in your earlier question that it has a very, very large say in the UN Security Council. The UN Security Council basically is a body in which five permanent members dictate to the rest of the world. And so they can get away literally with crimes and murder, and nobody can touch them. If, for instance, the United States wanted to stop this horrendous war in Yemen and stop these war crimes from being committed in Yemen, it could do so, because the United States is supporting the Saudi regime. It is providing intelligence information. It is, in fact, providing identifying targets for the Saudis to hit, although the Saudis are so incompetent that they often fail to hit military targets, and they target civilian populations, schools, hospitals, grain depots, and so on. The list is endless. I mean, the number of crimes that the Saudis have perpetrated in Yemen is absolutely horrendous. It is well known. It is well documented. The only people that are basically shying away from it is the UN Human Rights Council, under pressure from the Western regimes, because the Western regimes themselves are complicit in these crimes. We need to remember that since 9/11, the United States and its allies have murdered an estimated 32 million people worldwide. You can take Afghanistan and Iraq and Yemen and Libya and Syria, Lebanon, Somalia, Mali at the present time. In all of these countries, horrendous crimes are being perpetrated by the Western regimes. And this is well documented. This is not something, this is an Australian professor who did the analysis, and he came up with the figure of 32 million, largely civilians killed over the last 20 years. So what we are witnessing is that worldwide, all of these regimes are perpetrating these horrific crimes. And so in that sense, they are complicit in the Saudi crimes in Yemen as well. And that is why the U.S., although it has the power and the authority to stop these crimes, it doesn't want to do so, as we mentioned earlier, because if the war in Yemen ended, then who's going to be selling weapons to Saudi Arabia? The Saudis would not need any more weapons. And so it has to do with selling weapons. It has to do with Saudi Arabia serving as a cash cow. And it has to do with keeping that entire Middle East region unstable, so that the Zionist regime can continue to maintain its hegemony, and the people of the region, that is the Middle East, continue to pay a very, very heavy price.
You just made interesting points, Zafar. And Brian, so if it is the case, as Zafar has said, that obviously Washington could make this war in, so is it in the U.S.'s strategic interest to keep this war going? I mean, Zafar just talked about, and you also mentioned about, as far as selling arms. But at the end of the day, does it help the United States strategically to continue this war against Yemen?
No, it doesn't help the people of the United States. It doesn't help what really our U.S. interests. What it helps is the arms industry, and it's the people of the United States in various ways, not as dramatically immediately as the people of Yemen. But we're in a country with a decaying infrastructure. We have we are the industrialized country with the most inept healthcare, education system. Things are falling apart here because of the same thing. This is not helping the United States. It's helping the corporations that own the politicians. So no, it's not in anyone's interest. And I think the United States really ought to, at this point, with the challenge of climate change, ought to be thinking about other options rather than using our own shale oil that was considered too dirty to process only a few years ago, or trying to control the oil flow out of the Middle East. We need to be finding alternatives, and that would be to the interest of the United States, of its people, but it would be very hard on the arms manufacturers and the U.S.-based petroleum industry.
Well, Zafar, we have seen the Yemenis be resilient in fighting back and trying to resist the Saudi-led onslaught. Do you think that the more the Yemenis feel that injustice is being waged against them by the Saudis and their supporters, the more defiant the Yemenis have become?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the people of Yemen have demonstrated over the last 6.5 years or so that they will not tolerate foreign aggression They have shown remarkable resilience despite the fact that they are extremely poor. They have paid a very heavy price, but they are now hitting back. And I think this is something that we need to look at in the broader context, in the sense that when people are under oppression, when people are getting killed, they are being bombed, crimes are being committed against them, they are left with absolutely no choice but to fight back. And I think in case of Yemen, and we saw earlier in Afghanistan as well, where the people fought against the U.S. and its allies for 20 years, ultimately driving the U.S. out of Afghanistan, although it cost the U.S. $2.26 trillion, and all of that money has gone down the drain. But in case of Yemen, the Yemenis are putting up a very stiff resistance, and they're also targeting vital military installations inside Saudi Arabia. And I think that the time is getting closer when the Yemenis would be able to get rid of this Saudi aggression, to defeat the Saudi aggressors completely, and perhaps even as a bonus to get rid of the ruling corrupt Saudi family, because they have been a bane not only for the people of Saudi Arabia, but virtually the entire Muslim world. And so that day, we hope, is sooner rather than later, but definitely we salute the Yemeni people for their courageous resistance in the face of enormous odds.
On that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us on the Spotlight, the Director, Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto, and political commentator and peace activist Brian Terrell out of Molloy, Iowa. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The sunset in the heaven. A special program for the anniversary of martyrdom of 11th star in the heaven of the Imamate, Imam Hassan al-Askari.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In name of the supporter of the oppressed Salam alaikum, respectable audience We're with you with another program Sunset in the Heaven In this program we commemorate the memory of our martyred Imam Imam Hassan al-Askari Our 11th leader and Imam Today we want to look deeper into the life of Imam Hassan al-Askari To do that we have Dr. Batul Najafi with us here She has her PhD in Islamic Sciences from the Seminary School of Jamiatul Zahra in Qom. Dr. Najafi, welcome to our program.
Thank you so much for having me here. Most welcome.
It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Okay, we would like to learn a little more about the life of Imam Hassan al-Askari. Ask some questions. I'd like to start with the first question, which is,
Could you please tell us a little about the conditions